Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
I mean, living in Detroit right now, you feel like you're on one of the front lines of this historical process, like Greece, like Puerto Rico, like these different places where aggressive, top-down, corporate-based state policies are used to restructure the community, not only its debt and not only its government, but its entire culture and sense of itself. And what emergency management and the bankruptcy did in Detroit really was just decapitate the, you know, the social capital and the local government to the extent that people are still trying to find ways to deal with this new circumstance. And we're in the throes of that right now.
The front lines, he says, the leading, bleeding edge of the financial assault on the citizens of Detroit, Michigan, who resemble those other financial basket cases created by the pillars of private finance, like Greece, Cyprus, Iceland, Puerto Rico, Ireland, and so on. Hello once again. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, with another edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Today we'll spend a little time examining what Wall Street's destructive financing agenda, executed through the politicians in Lansing, Michigan, has done to one of America's greatest historical centers of productivity. Detroit has lost not only tens of thousands of its citizens to the shrinking industries and the profit-taking of corporate board suites, but much more in terms of its community fabric and culture. It resembles the plight of many other cities around the U.S. that the Public Banking Institute's project called What Wall Street Costs America is portraying in this new project, intended to open a national discussion about what we can do to save ourselves from the financial powers that seem to have no regard for the people who produce the profits. As our guest points out, this is how capitalist interests treat the communities that drove their profits for so long. Discarded, disenfranchised, dismissed, just plain dissed. Matt Stannard will be along with a very interesting interview with Tom Stevens of Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management later in the program. But also on today's program, we'll return to another portion of Ellen's fine conversation with Dr. Roseanne Junker, the preeminent expert and historian on the Bank of North Dakota, America's only publicly owned bank, and a roaring success for almost 100 years. Roseanne will talk about the politics and the financial platforms that have made this bank such a success. If you're a public banking aficionado or just keenly interested, you won't want to miss this installment of Ellen's discussion with Dr. Junker. And while the politics of North Dakota played into the creation of the public bank, politics in our day are not so dissimilar. Ellen and I touched on some of the monetary issues that are emerging in this year's presidential election, and also talked about one of the new technical monetary developments that may give us a side channel to improve our monetary functions.
No matter who actually wins the primaries and who wins the presidency, the fact that Bernie Sanders has really pushed this issue about breaking up the Wall Street banks and what to do about the Wall Street banks has put it on everybody's radar, so it pretty much has to be addressed by whoever gets up there. It is a very tricky problem. So the three proposals that are on the table are break up the big banks, reimpose Glass-Steagall, and increase the capital requirements of the big banks so that supposedly so they'd be prepared for a major crisis like we had in 2008. However, all of those remedies are deficient, as I've been reading. If you break up the big banks, the proposal is to break them up to something smaller than $50 billion in assets, but that's still a very large bank, and it's still quite a bit larger than Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns, which brought down the economy in 2008. So a bunch of smaller too big to fail, but, you know, smaller banks with a whole lot of derivatives that are still very risky and still not democratized or still not, you know, serving the public interest could be just as bad or even potentially even worse than a few big ones. And if you reimpose Glass-Steagall, the problem is, again, Lehman Brothers was already an independent investment bank. It wasn't a depository bank. So Glass-Steagall separated investment banking from depository banking, but the pundits, you know, the people on the other side of the argument say that you're actually safer as an investment bank if you are also a depository bank. An investment bank that doesn't have the liquidity of deposits can be bankrupt overnight, as Lehman Brothers was, because no matter how you look at it, they're using other people's money. So they're either using other people's deposits in the case of a depository bank, or if they're a regular investment bank, they might be using money market funds, as Lehman Brothers was. All the liquidity in this whole system is basically bank IOUs. It's all IOUs. There's no real money in the system. So what I've been researching lately is a potential solution is in blockchain, which is something that you normally think of it as being Bitcoin, which is, you know, a currency that's kind of the thing of, like, libertarians. You know, it's kind of a culty thing, and you don't think of it as a solution to the derivatives crisis, but it actually could be, because blockchain is more than currencies. It's basically just a computer program that eliminates the middleman. So you can basically eliminate banks. You do the trade. It's kind of peer-to-peer trading, but you can actually, I mean, you can see how that works if you're just doing sort of community currency trading stuff. But derivatives are very complicated, but you can actually do derivatives on blockchain, because the blockchain...
Would you describe what blockchain is?
I hope I can explain it. It's called a distributed ledger. So instead of being stored in one place, like the way you normally do a trade, for example, in derivatives, is you have to have this third party. It's called a trusted third party, but I was reading somewhere, there's no such thing as a trusted third party. In other words, you may trust them personally, but they can all go bankrupt and your money can disappear. But the way it's normally done is both parties give their money to the trusted third party, and whoever wins this bet gets the money. In a distributed ledger, it's all done by computer, and there is no trusted third party. It goes automatically. Whoever wins the bet automatically gets the money. And along with it are these what are called smart contracts. So you can have all the terms of your contract, and it can all be built into the computer program so that it all executes automatically. It's totally transparent. There are people all around the world. You know, anybody who wants to can look and see what's going on with the deal, although you still have your anonymity personally. But the deal itself, I guess, is totally shared, and it's called distributed because it's got a bunch of different nodes where all this information is. So you can't lose it. Like, if the bank goes bankrupt, the money doesn't disappear at all. It's all up there in the cloud, so to speak. So I'm not sure I totally understand it myself. I just think it's a very cool idea.
It's like a clearing system for credits. Might that be a very simple way of describing it?
Yeah, that would be a simple peer-to-peer digital system. But it turns out you can also do very complicated things on it, like derivatives and like mortgages, like with MERS. You know how MERS was the supposedly trusted third party where it held all the mortgages, and we know it wasn't trusted at all, and the mortgages kind of disappeared down the MERS rabbit hole.
Yeah, MERS standing for Mortgage Electronic Recording System.
Right? Yeah, registration system, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, which replaced, or at least tried to replace, the role of the recorder of deeds in counties and cities around the country, and created a huge mess and lawsuits.
Yeah, so all that could be done on a blockchain distributed ledgers. So it's kind of like it's a whole new world of financial transactions where you don't need the middleman.
So you don't need a bank.
Yeah, technically you don't need a bank. You could need a bank for other things. I mean, I would think in the ideal model, you still need deposits and loans. Somebody's got to decide who gets the loan. You know, you still need basic banking services. And to the extent that you do need a middleman, it seems to me that ideally you would have a central bank that was a truly publicly owned public service entity that was there to serve the public. I mean, if you took all these new developments, all these financial developments, and you made them public institutions designed to serve the public, just think what you could do. You could have complete liquidity without the potential of collapse because you've got the central bank backing everything up. You've got responsible parties serving the public interest, making decisions about where this money is supposed to go or what's to be done. I mean, it seems to me we're on the edge of a whole of great possibilities.
Right.
In which we can eliminate that great parasite that we call the...
And the big banks now are looking at digital dimensions are the future of their business.
Yes, but I think that even the digital aspect can be turned to advantage. I mean, it could be a good thing if we had a system that was totally... Well, blockchain is called trustless because you don't need trust. Trust is not a necessary element of the system. You don't need to trust the people who are running it because nobody's running it. It runs by itself. It's all designed in a way that's totally egalitarian, totally fair. I mean, I'm not sure how that's done, but let's assume totally transparent, totally distributed, so it's stored in many different places. Yeah.
You know, Ellen, if this were TV, I'd ask you to draw us a picture of how it all works. But your new article is going to be focusing on this.
It is really interesting. I mean, the woman at J.P. Morgan Chase, who developed derivatives in the 1990s, so now she's jumped over into blockchain. She's quit J.P. Morgan and has her own blockchain company. So that's how hot it is. It's the hottest new thing.
Wow.
And Reggie Middleton, who is on Max Kaiser a lot, he also is an innovator in that field, and he's out to put J.P. Morgan out of business. So that's the potential of it.
All right,
whether
so
or not we understand it just yet, it's something to watch.
So we're getting from monetary reform to monetary transformation here.
Yeah.
So we've got some interesting futures to discuss. And thanks very much for this insight, Ellen. We'll get to more of it as it materializes or as you bring it about.
Sure. Great talking to you.
Thank you.
This week, we continue the conversation that Ellen began last time with Dr. Roseanne Enerson-Junker, the preeminent authority on the Bank of North Dakota, America's only, for the moment, publicly owned bank. Roseanne holds a doctorate in history, political science, and anthropology, and wrote the seminal work, The Bank of North Dakota, An Experiment in State Ownership. With the interest in public banking growing all around the country, this election year has brought a political focus on how such an effective civic partner as the Bank of North Dakota thrives politically.
Yeah, this whole thing about the Bank of North Dakota being a socialist institution and North Dakota being a very red state, but it seems to me it's not really. I mean, socialist is the wrong word for it because it's really very capitalist because you've got all those farmers who are individual entrepreneurs, and they need the support, so they're just supporting each other. It's more like a co-op, but they're supporting each other with their own. Instead of allowing this sort of parasitic out-of-state system to draw off all their profits, they're becoming self-sufficient, which is capitalism.
It's one of those easy labels that you can throw on things, and I don't think that this new generation sees the socialism label. I think that they really look at the Nordic countries more than the... And, you know, that's the thing, too. I mean, think about North Dakota as a... North Dakota has been a very independent state. People ran... I mean, the nonpartisan league ran its candidates on the Republican ticket because the McKenzie machine was a Republican machine. But they also ran a few people on the Democratic ticket, just equal opportunity here, just in case. And the populist movement and the progressive movement is very strong, and you have the sense of independence of the farmers, as you mentioned. And you also have people who were primarily Scandinavian heritage with a sense of community and responsibility for a community and helping each other. And you think of it as a red state, but We've had a Democratic U.S. senator for the last 55 years. One of our two senators has been a Democratic NPL senator. And for almost the last 30 years, until 2011, and for almost 30 years, we had two Democratic U.S. senators. You know, so even though the state officials may be Republican, the national officials have been, for the last 30 years, primarily Democrats and not conservative Democrats. So, yes, it's socially conservative, but it has a strong sense of political independence as well.
Maybe you could talk a little more about A.C. Townley and how he mobilized the people, because, you know, we've got a couple of leaders that are of that temperament today. We've got Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, who are also sort of populist rabble-rousers. I mean, you know, charismatic leaders.
Isn't it?
Yeah, because we're at the stage where people are feeling they want change. They don't want to vote for the establishment. They don't like the establishment anymore. They want something new. They're feeling revolutionary, but it just in terms of people are feeling exploited and they're ready for something might be considered rocking the boat or radical or something. Now they don't like what we've got and they want something new. So how did he manage to...
Well, it's interesting. Townley is an interesting character because you could really say that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party today are the equivalent of the machine politics 100 years ago. You know, they're entrenched. Certainly Hillary Clinton has the backing of the Democratic Party, and she's worked very hard for it, and she's been a staunch supporter in her Democratic bona fides. But you do have people that are just tired of politics as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Townley, you know, the Nonpartisan League was probably the high point of his life. He lived another 40 years after the creation of the Bank of North Dakota, and he didn't live a good life. He tried selling any number of things. He ran for office two or three different times, and he never got back on his feet. I can't help but think that losing his farm in 1913 and capturing that spirit of change, those two things combined to make him a very effective speaker.
We get ask a lot of questions just about the nuts and bolts and what the legislation was. The only thing I've seen is like a one-pager, which was pretty simple. I wonder if you could describe what actual bills they passed, you know, how the bank was governed, and you said about the state deposits went into the bank and then they went into the local banks.
There were three bills that were passed in order to start the Bank of North Dakota. One was the enabling legislation, and one was appropriations for the bank itself. And then the third one, the bank was required to start within 90 days after it was signed by the governor. The provisions first state that the bank is to promote agriculture, commerce, and industry, and that's continued to this day. They set up the governing body, the Industrial Commission of the governing body, and I think I mentioned that the Industrial Commission was to make and enforce all the orders and the rules and the bylaws, and it's made up of the governor, the commissioner of agriculture, and the secretary of state. It said that the bank can do anything that any bank can legally do, that all of the state, county, township, municipal, and school district funds and funds of the educational institutions, state educational institutions, industrial institutions, and penal institutions all had to be deposited within the Bank of North Dakota within the first 3 months, and that all of the deposits are guaranteed by the state, and that the bank can loan to any of the departments, the institutions, the utilities, business within the state. There was $100,000 appropriated out of the general fund to carry out the provisions, and it was declared an emergency. Now, $100,000, we have to think of what $100,000 was in 1919. It's certainly a lot more money than it was today. The idea that they were to get this bank up and running within 3 months of being enacted, because there were people had to put their crops in. They needed money to get their crops in. The whole idea of organizing the bank certainly had a lot to do with stabilizing the interest rates and bringing the interest rates down. And the bank immediately caused the interest rates to drop by 3 percentage points. The interest rates immediately went from 12% to 9%.
The Commonwealth Bank of Australia, too, they forced the private banks to lower their rates. So they set the tone.
You know, it's when you have your priorities straight, right?
What about the city deposits? They don't go in the...
Yes, they do. That was the townships. municipal and county.
Okay, so they all go in the state bank, and then my understanding was that they partner with the local banks to help with liquidity, but so they actually put the deposits into the local
bank? They did initially. This is an irony, right? They did initially because they wanted the support of the state banks. The director general had been head of the North Dakota Bankers Association. He knew that if these municipalities all put their money in the state bank, the local banks would be losing a lot of their deposits that they used to loan against. And
right.
So he promised to put the municipality money back into these local banks, which he did. Well, during one of the referendums that the Independent Voters Association put on the ballot, it said the municipalities and townships don't have to put their money into the Bank of North Dakota. So all of a sudden, the Bank of North Dakota was losing liquidity. And so it said to the state banks where it had put initial deposits, okay, you guys, give us our money back. And the state bank said, oh, no, we can't do that. And so there's a huge number of state banks that failed. They fell on their own sword. You know, they didn't realize that if they were to create a liquidity crisis in the Bank of North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota would withdraw those funds that they had redeposited in the state banks. They would bring those funds back. Hence, the state banks would be in trouble. So the state banks made a mistake, and eventually they cleared it up, but not before a number of state banks failed. They created their own problem.
In California and a lot of other states, for the local banks to take state deposits, they have to put up 110% collateral. And so now the local banks don't want the state deposits because they can't make any money off that. You know, interest rates are so low. The collateral is very short-term federal securities, which they can make almost nothing on. So, but in North Dakota, then, they don't have to do that, right? They guarantee the deposits so that, I mean, the state bank.
The state guarantees the deposits of the state bank. So they're in a sense self-insuring.
So now, effectively, the deposits are all in the Bank of North Dakota, but then they partner with the local banks buying a portion of the loan.
Well, you know, a lot of the local banks make loans which they sell to the Bank of North Dakota. The Bank of North Dakota takes those loans from a number of the local banks and packages them and then resells them.
To private investors?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm, cool.
So it really serves, I mean, it really, North Dakota is a small state and there are a number of small banks. And it's kind of like having, it's like having a sugar daddy, you know, in your back pocket where you can make these loans and then you sell them to the Bank of North Dakota and you get your money back and then you can continue to make more loans, sell them to the Bank of North Dakota. North Dakota packages them from around the state and then can sell them to larger banks.
Or another way of looking at it is that the local banks are really the front office for the state bank, but they're independent contractors or like franchises of the state.
You know, that's a really good way of putting it because the Bank of North Dakota does not have any branches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the things that it agreed to. It only has the bank in Bismarck. It doesn't have any branches around the state. So the state banks really are the Bank of North Dakota's fingers into the local community.
And then people are always writing to me or asking me, can I open an account at the Bank of North Dakota? But, of course, they can't.
You can.
If you're an out-of-state person, can you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know why not. I mean, I had an account there. And it was so funny because, of course, when I was working on my dissertation, Herb Thorndahl was the president of the bank at that time. And he said, why are you having a personal bank account here? You know, you need to get credit. You need to, you know, develop your credit at some place that's going to lend you money. And I said, well, I don't want to borrow any money. I just wanted an account. I still have pencils that say Bank of North Dakota on them. And those pencils are 30 years old. Anyway, you can have a savings account. You can have a checking account, I believe. I actually should check that because I'm not quite certain. You could 30 years ago. But again, it doesn't make private loans. If I needed to borrow money for a car, I wouldn't be able to do it. You know, I'd be better off at a credit union or something. So,
mm-hmm. Or you could borrow from a local bank, which then packaged up your loan with a bunch of others and sold it.
I think it's more probably the real estate loans that the local bank can make the loans on, you know, because it's the real estate loans, small business loans that can be packaged to the Bank of North Dakota, but personal loans are not something that they package. I've come across this statement by the first director general. Remember we were talking about socialism and where they would oppose the bank on socialism. And of course, this is right during the Russian Revolution and all this stuff was going on at the same time the Bank of North Dakota was started. But this fellow, and remember, he's the banker. He says, our people have resented injustice, but never revolted in a way that indicates a spirit of red revolution. They resort to the constitutional ballot for the redress of their grievances. They are sober-minded, studious, and industrious, and they give careful consideration to the economic problems and decide carefully and wisely. You know, if there's no tendency towards anarchy. People are law-abiding, with no large industrial centers, no large mining towns, and no large congestions of population. There is no chance for Bolshevism to take the place here. You know, he's saying that's not what it's about. What it's about is using people's own money to support them. And you know, Jerry Brown did this when he was governor the first time around, when he had the pension investment unit, and he worked very hard with public and private pension funds to focus their investments on California-based investments. There was every good reason to put the investments of the public employees and the state teachers association based in California. There's plenty of California, sound California investments for those pension funds to invest in. So it's pretty much a similar idea.
Well, and how is it that the Bank of North Dakota makes, I saw they made a 1% loans to build a school, I think it was the end of 2014. Meanwhile, here in California, we have these capital appreciation bonds that can go to 1,500%, like in Orange County. They're getting in them from Wall Street, from Goldman Sachs. So how is it that the Bank of North Dakota can afford those loans? Is that they take a loss on those? Or?
You know, I doubt they take a loss. On the other hand, they don't have to make a huge profit. They don't have to take a loss, but if the cost of money to them is 0.5% and they're lending something out at 1%, they're not going to take a loss. And yet, I mean, I can't imagine a school in Southern California having to pay that kind of interest.
Yeah, well, it's like 40 years later, and that's how they do it. That's how they get away with it. But I suppose it's just supply and demand, that school boards don't have any other option and they need whatever school facilities. And so.
And sometimes you have to give credit to the elected officials of North Dakota to say, here are the things we value. Mm-hmm. And education has always been one of the things that, again, a lot of it comes from the Scandinavian heritage. Education has been one, it's very, very important. You know, think of all the different Lutheran colleges that were started as soon as the Lutheran Church got established in North Dakota and Minnesota. Education has always been an important thing to that population, German as well.
Yeah, it's really part of, somebody called it social infrastructure. You want to educate your people so they can contribute to the economy. So you might think of it as bleeding heart socialism, you know, bleeding heart welfare or something, but it's not.
It's an investment in the future.
Of the economy, of the state.
Well, the future of your state, because what do you have? What you really have is people. That's all you have is people. And you want to have an educated population. You know, not everybody needs to go to college. Not everybody. You need to have plumbers and electricians, but education in the trades as well as higher education should be the first thing that we invest in, it seems to me, as a state.
And there was the famous example of after World War II, that the GI Bill invested education for the soldiers as well as low interest home loans and low interest business loans, and they got their money back 7 times over.
And, you know, North Dakota, through the Bank of North Dakota, created student loans before the federal national student loan. In fact, North Dakota made the first shared national student loan because it already had that in place through the Bank of North Dakota. And they also did the same thing with the returning veterans loan program for education before the federal program. I mean, it's what do you care about? And by having the bank and being able to invest in social programs, using social capital to invest in social programs, that supports your economy is essentially what the bank is doing.
And it seems to me you think what you care about and then people think like religious values or something like that, but that's really not it. I mean, the things like investing in education and investing in building things for the people is really supporting the economy. I mean, it's really a practical money-saving investment rather than putting your money into some high-flying thing in Wall Street where in the end you're going to be paying lots of fees that you're not anticipating. I mean, you're always playing with a more sophisticated player than you are, so you can almost count on losing in the Wall Street casino.
It's also, you just manage your risk. And so some things have a higher interest rate than other things, but the things that you want to support, like education or family farms or, you know, your state municipalities, you can support those. You can make loans at a lower rate. Not everything has to be equal. This is a fascinating, I mean, California, there's the same number of people in California as there is in Canada. You know,
there are 50 times as many people in California as in North Dakota.
50 times more?
50.
Yeah, I think there's like 750,000 people here, so that's about right.
Yeah, and in California, that just in the Treasurer's investment pool, which is all the slush funds from various government state entities, there's $67 billion currently making 0.5% interest, a little less than that. So it's making almost nothing and a huge amount of money. So if you put that in your own bank and called it deposits, then you would be able to create 90% of that in the form of loans. So you could basically double your money. So it's an opportunity.
Well, so where is the political will going to come from to do something like that?
I think there actually is some political will. I mean, you know, we're talking to legislators who are interested, particularly today when things are, California's facing a $700 billion infrastructure bill over the next 10 years. Money they just don't have currently. They need some new sources. They can't raise taxes without big protests, and they can't slash services without big protests. So it's the third way. Let's create our own money the way all banks do by created out of our own deposits.
You know, the thing is you've got some pretty large banking interests in California as well, you know, that are going to...
But they're out-of-state interests, so it's...
Well, here's the irony, isn't it? When was Wells Fargo acquired by the Minneapolis Bank? I mean, that's very funny that we're talking about those Minneapolis bankers.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Bank of America is now a North Carolina bank. Wells Fargo is at least headquartered in California. You know, it's certainly a worthy effort. It's certainly a worthy effort. And
and it's exciting. The possibilities are exciting that we don't have to be limited to raising taxes or cutting services. There are other ways to design a monetary system. And in fact, the current system is obsolete. It's actually where monetary reform is right now, that all the money reformers are arguing with each other over what the new system should be. But everybody knows that we need a change. It's just a question of devising the most efficient model.
You know, it is efficient. It's greed doesn't have to get into it. You know, I like that idea of a tidy profit. I think you use that in one of your statements, to make a tidy profit. I just think that's, I love that idea. You know, you don't have to maximize, but you can make a tidy profit. And that's somehow all you need to do. I wish California luck, and I certainly wish the other states and municipalities that are looking at this. I mean, certainly having people who understand the system and who have a experience is critical in the whole effort.
Yeah, so it's great to be able to get your insight. You've done a whole study on the whole area.
I have, and it's almost time to redo it, you know, because when I finished this, it was in the early 80s, the bank had put in $100 million into the state fund. They had generated $100 million for the state fund, and now I'm sure it's probably $500 million by now that they've generated into the state, you know, that they have earned. So not only are they allowing the state to implement all sorts of progressive policies, they're also earning money. I mean, you can't do better than that. You know, that the $100 million in 1980 was literally money that's just given back to the state to do what it wants to, not in the bank itself. They've generated $1 billion in profits, and they're saying over the last 21 years, nearly $400 million has been transferred to the general fund. So that's $500 million. I mean, they've generated $1 billion in profit in the last 21 years, but 400 million of that billion has been transferred to the general fund to support education and other public services. So actually $500 million is not too far off.
Yeah, and considering it's such a small state of 680,000 or whatever, that lot of money. Yeah. Great. Well, it's been great speaking with you. Do you have anything you want to wrap up with? Concluding statement?
Well, I wish you and the public banking movement all the success because it's obviously worked in North Dakota. There's obviously different situations in different places, but the idea is sound. You know, the idea is sound. So I just say good luck and go for it, and I hope it works. Thank you, Ellen, and all the best.
Okay, same to you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Roseanne Anderson-Junker, author of The Bank of North Dakota, An Experiment in State Ownership.
And now we take a look at what Wall Street costs America. Today, we take a look at what Wall Street is costing Detroit. Here's Matt Stannard.
I am speaking with Tom Stevens, who is a communications coordinator with Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. He's much more than that, and this is a longstanding task that he and others have had, responding to the momentous events of the last few years in Detroit. Talking to him about those events right now and the role that Wall Street played in those events. Thanks so much for being with us, Tom. There's a national narrative that the city of Detroit got what it deserved. How did Detroit end up being the scapegoat of deindustrialization in the American narrative?
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for that setup opening question. I think that if we live by symbols, Detroit has become a symbol of a lot of things, both parts, if they're, if you will, about capitalism. And also, I hear most recently that people all over the world are characterizing their own legacy urban communities as Detroits. You know, there's Spain's Detroit, and there's France's Detroit, and so forth and so on. The Ruhr Valley is Germany's Detroit. And I think that, you know, what happened basically, in a word, was capitalism. I mean, this is the way the system treats a community where crucial, historic, industrial developments occur technologically and socially and politically and in every other way. And then within the regional context that makes Detroit the most segregated metropolitan area in the United States today, and it has long been, this is the playing out of the way capital uses a community like this for its ends, and then when it becomes more profitable to do so, abandons it.
So getting a little more specific, there's another national narrative that the city, for example, was too generous with its pension benefits, and that is what got it into trouble. Of course, this doesn't stand up to the facts either, does it?
That's an amazing narrative, isn't it? I mean, how do you judge what's too generous? I mean, of course, what we know about the golden age of capitalism in the United States from approximately 1947 to approximately 1973 is that the high-wage proletariat that was created in Detroit, in the auto factories and in the auto parts factories and all the spin-off industries that auto generates, was a crucial element of the capitalist dynamism of that whole era, right? Because you would have effective demand because the workers were paid pretty well. But then under a different set of policy imperatives at a different age, and you know, I can't resist mentioning in this context the discussions now about how professional athletes relate with the world and the memory of the great Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, this level of exchange, this market and monopoly and state-established level of money and benefits and quality of life that you get for a really hard job for your whole life that leaves your body barely able to function, all of a sudden it's too generous. You know, people have this drummed into them. They have it drummed into them in school. It's drummed into them by the corporate media. It's drummed into them by every type of pedagogical and moral and intellectual authority in our lives. and it's complete nonsense, right? I mean, you're either getting a fair deal or you're not getting a fair deal. We're not getting a fair deal, and that's what has led to the more recent developments in Detroit. When we were getting a fair deal, Detroit was the pride of the whole industrial world and the country, of course.
So there's a huge economic context to what eventually happened in 2005 and 2006. But to make a long story short, at that time, the city entered into these complex debt deals that assumed about $1.6 billion in debt. They were certificates of participation, some of which carried variable interest rates that were then swapped into fixed interest rates. This was very risky. Why did the city do it?
Well, again, let's step back for a minute from the swap deals themselves, which who knows even, you know, who's listening to this conversation, what they even mean. And let's recognize that the policy decision to fund urban government in the 1970s era after the Golden Age that I referenced earlier with debt instead of taxes have these consequences, right? We're no longer going to tax those who can afford to pay taxes to support a great city that's a great place to live. So the alternative was to borrow it and pay it back to those same people who we would have taxed otherwise with interest. And that created a whole series of complications, which, and you referenced 2005, 2006, of course, you've got this massive bubble that somehow most mainstream economists, corporate economists, capitalists somehow couldn't see, although there were a few voices in the wilderness, of course. And if you've seen the movie The Big Short, you know what an opportunity it was for those who were pursuing it.
Mm-hmm.
And in cities, not only Detroit, but in this context, I think it's helpful to say Detroit is just like all the other communities, except more so. In cities, the choice to borrow the money instead of getting the money from taxes to run your city had these implications, and as you referenced, variable interest rates. I think what you're primarily focusing on here is what is called interest rate swaps.
Yeah.
So when the city or the city's water department, which is effectively a regional entity, needed to fund its operation, it would go to Wall Street, it would borrow the money with bonds, and the interest rates on those bonds would float. And in order to protect itself from the risk of high interest rates, the city would further purchase these swaps. And not only Detroit did this, but a bunch of them did it. And the way the swaps work is essentially as a bet. The city is putting money down, and if the interest rate on the bonds associated with the swaps as they're being paid back in the future goes up, the entity on the other side of the bet, in the case of the city, there was UBS and there was Bank of America were the big ones, and then there were a bunch in the water department too, and it's hundreds of millions of dollars. The entity on the other side of that would cover it to keep their interest rate low. But if the interest rate goes down, as of course happened after the crash of 2007-2008, according to the terms of the bet or the interest rate swap instruments, the city would be on the hook to pay the other side of the deal, to pay hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And if they didn't pay, if they wanted to buy out, they'd have to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to buy out.
Right.
In retrospect, it looks completely insane, and it was irresponsible even in prospect at the time, because as I started this lengthy explanation talking about the bubble, the guys that sold the swaps knew about the bubble. The guys that sold the swaps knew that when the bubble burst, under the too-big-to-fail doctrine, government would come to the rescue and lower those interest rates, and those swaps would become lucrative cash cows for the banks, and that's what happened. And it's important to realize that it wasn't only the swaps that bankrupted Detroit. The cash flow crisis, the excessive debt load that was used as an excuse for this massive restructuring in the interests of neoliberal austerity and elites profiting was partly and significantly the swaps, but it was the whole debt model which produced the swaps, if that makes any sense.
And then, so a few years ago, we get into the emergency management and the bankruptcy, and at that time, emergency manager Kevin Orr says that the city has $18 billion in long-term debt. But that's not the whole picture, right? That's not even there's something that is fundamentally not true about the way that Orr is representing the city's financial condition.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, as Demos, the think tank, pointed out, the real problem was $198 million cash flow crisis over the annual budget. And that's a real problem, not to minimize that. But it's a different problem than a $7 or $8 billion debt overhang, right? And it calls for different solutions. And when you say emergency management, I'm not sure how much people listening to this know about that. This is a totally unprecedented Michigan policy under Governor Rick Snyder, who came in and he was elected in 2010 along with the other Republican oligarchs throughout the Midwest, and modified a long-standing statute that allowed for the appointment of emergency financial managers who would have budget authority over troubled municipalities into this thing called emergency management, which means that the emergency manager in Detroit, the bankruptcy lawyer from Jones Day, Kevin Orr, not only has financial power over the city, he has all the power that the city government has, all the powers of the mayor, all the powers of the council, all the powers of the pension board, all the powers of the water department, plus other powers to break contracts, for example, and to violate any local law or charter in order to structurally readjust the city and the city's budget to the demands of capital. And that's what he did.
Take us from the, and we know, of course, that the bankruptcy hearings were arduous, that there was a huge human and social cost to them. Take us from that time to the present time and answer, is there a risk that the city, as it recovers, could fall into similar financing traps? What's the state of the consciousness of finance in the city today?
Well, that's a real good question, and I don't know that we know the full answer yet. We probably don't. I would refer people to the website of Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management, which if you Google that, it's on there. And then as one of our statements, which is prominently noted in one of the links, we have one, a new one called Detroit 2016, in which we try to address what you're asking right now. It's about 12 pages, pretty easy read with lots of pictures. Yes, there is certainly a risk that we could be back in bankruptcy court because bankruptcy didn't really fix any of the real problems. I mean, if you take a city that is plagued by the kind of inequality and poverty and the whole litany of social problems facing American cities today and in the extreme, and you simply run its government balance sheet through bankruptcy and cut off some of the debt and provide some access to credit on arguably reasonable terms that gives you cash flow for the next few years, which is what they did, you haven't solved any of the underlying problems, right? You still have what they call spatial racism, which is a geographical mismatch between where there's jobs and opportunity and where most of the people in this city live. You have in the downtown, greater Detroit downtown redevelopment agenda, billions of dollars pouring into about 7.2 square miles out of the city. Well, the whole city is about 139 square miles. What's happening in the surrounding neighborhoods? Massive foreclosures on a scale that are not seen in any other city in the country. Massive water shutoffs on a scale that's never been seen anywhere in history before in an advanced system like this. That's what the special rapporteur on water said when she visited here and toured and examined the situation and talked to folks.
Right.
The almost complete destruction of public education in favor of, you know, the usual suspects, charters, vouchers, so-called accountability for teachers and teachers' unions. The whole neoliberal agenda really on steroids. I mean, living in Detroit right now, you feel like you're on one of the front lines of this historical process, like Greece, like Puerto Rico, like these different places where aggressive, top-down, corporate-based state policies are used to restructure the community, not only its debt and not only its government, but its entire culture and sense of itself. And what emergency management and the bankruptcy did in Detroit really was just decapitate the, you know, the social capital and the local government to the extent that people are still trying to find ways to deal with this new circumstance. And we're in the throes of that right now. Last week, the Michigan's policymaking elite gathered at the Northern Michigan resort community of Mackinac Island for something called the Mackinac Conference that happens every year under the auspices of the Regional Detroit Chamber of Commerce. And it was striking how little triumphalism there was compared to previous, especially the most recent years, where, you know, Governor Snyder was received like a rock star. But now, with the disaster that he wrought through emergency management in Flint, and with the continuing inability to do anything remotely reasonable or hopeful about Detroit public schools,
the tone has really changed. And, of course, they don't have the structural or critical analytical tools to tell the truth like we are right now to discuss it in real terms. But there is this pervasive sense that, yes, Detroit downtown is on the mend, but what about the neighborhoods? What about the people? What about the education? And that's where we stand right now. It's impossible to be really optimistic about it, except that the people of Detroit are so resilient and so much more than they're given credit for in the dominant national conversation that we will see, time will tell, how we deal with this amazing series of events that we're discussing right now.
You actually kind of took the words right out of my mouth, because I was going to say, you know, during this time and during the last few years, I've been so fortunate to meet many of these activists, from, you know, people who are running for office to people who are simply creating their own neighborhood economic communities in Detroit. And when you talk about resilient, and when you talk about, you know, the real people on the front lines, it's kind of a cliche that disaster sometimes brings out the best in people. But there's a lot that is inspiring about what the people are doing in Detroit.
Yeah, I mean, this has been going on for a long time, of course. I mean, we started off talking about ever since World War II, right? And so there's a intergenerational, multi-generational sense in Detroit of, one, this is a place that has the power in various ways to change the world, whether it's a production system like the assembly line and the overall system that is often referred to as Fordism, or whether it's Motown, or our jazz musicians are also, you know, diamonds in the rough, prized by jazz fans all over the world, and the techno and hip-hop scene, or whether it's, you know, the arsenal of democracy. I don't know if people have ever heard Walter Reuther's speech about converting the auto industry to war production, but, you know, when the United States found itself at the end of 1941 thrown into the war after sort of trying to aid the British against the Nazis for a few years, the corporate giants responded to the Roosevelt administration's call for mobilization and said, wait a minute, we can't do that fast. And it was Walter Reuther who stepped forward and said, yes, we can. This is how we're going to do it. And, you know, I've always thought that was one of the real hidden histories of Detroit that people need to understand, because it shows the different mindset of the guy who makes the camshafts from the guy who, you know, runs the company and pays other people to do it and skims the profits. And I would submit that that is a crucial insight into what's happening now with this business about, you know, fixing the city's balance sheet versus quality of life and how does Detroit go forward in the 21st century, right? There's these profitable abstractions that the 1% lives by, and then there's the way the 99% lives. And, you know, you can't be in Detroit and for any length of time and not begin to get a new understanding of that, in my opinion.
We've been talking to Thomas Stevens. He's with Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management. They have a statement on their webpage, Detroit 2016, that everyone should read. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That's Matt Standard with today's What Wall Street Costs America. We'll look at another American city next time. And for more information about the What Wall Street Costs America project and how you can participate, visit whatwallstreetcosts.org or come to the Public Banking Institute website at publicbankinginstitute.org.
On Wall Street.
And now a word for those of you who would like to get involved or learn more about how a public bank may help your community, whether it's a city, county, or state. The Public Banking Institute provides a host of services and materials to help you get familiar with how these banking institutions can help alleviate and perhaps even turn around the deteriorating financial issues that are facing many of America's municipalities and other governments. Whether the chronic financing issues of your locale relate to how to support schools, repair and rejuvenate deteriorating infrastructure, lower the upward pressure on taxation, open up new lines of affordable credit that can invigorate small businesses as well as local lending institutions, or many of the other concerns and needs that typically accompany public agencies and administrations. A publicly owned public interest bank can help meet these needs in a whole new way. Maybe you're part of a civic group that has a focus on the economic hardship of some of your neighbors, or you desire to support small business, or perhaps help generate some green industries in your community, or so many other things that we all know are out there that need help. If so, you should give some thought to the public bank solution. Or alternatively, you can ask yourself, how do you think these concerns are ever going to get handled? Maybe Washington or your state government likely to step in? Do you also believe in the tooth fairy? Well, you know, the point is, as we've said so many times on this program, the changes we want to see will be realized when we get busy bringing them about ourselves. And of course, it's going to take money to do them. Even the best-intentioned civic leader has got to deal with the challenge of finance because they don't have great choices if they don't own a bank. They don't want to create more debt, and raising taxes is a non-starter for many. But the public bank solution offers something new, a way to create money from the equity that your community already has. A public bank can literally create the funds in the same way other banks do through loans. And as you heard on the program today from Roseanne Junker, that little state-owned bank out there in North Dakota has produced about $500 million in the last 30 years alone. So let's give some serious thought to this, shall we? The concept of public banking is proven the world over to be a successful way to enable civic growth and stability, and to separate ourselves from the predatory lending of Wall Street that has been skimming the public's wealth for generations. Let's start taking control of our money by creating new American public banks. This is an historic opportunity, and you're just fortunate enough to be alive to help bring it about. So get in touch with us, okay? And let's discuss how we can help you make this happen. Visit our website to learn much more. That's publicbankinginstitute.org. Lots of audio and video and other materials, as well as a list of regional coordinators around the country who can put you in touch with more local efforts. Or you can drop me a note as well at walt@publicbankinginstitute.org. Take care, and remember, it's our money. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money!